A new shelter for the chronically homeless in Everett, along with a new law and an update on the potential ballot measure that would force Seattle's hand when it comes to addressing homelessness. Hannah Scott has both. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, we're going to do the update on Compassion Seattle because it happened when you were out of town, and I thought you'd want to hear about it. So,
yes, thank you.
Quick update. Compassion Seattle, of course, is the proposed charter amendment to the city of Seattle that would really kind of force Seattle's hand to do specific things for addressing the homeless situation. In a recent sit-down with GeekWire's Mike Lewis, former city council president Tim Burgess detailed the specifics of the charter amendment.
Charter Amendment 29, if adopted by the voters of Seattle, creates a compassionate, outcome-based plan of action for dealing with homelessness in our city, and primarily those living unsheltered in our parks, play fields, sidewalks across the city. At the last official count, which was in January of 2020, there's just over 3,700 of these individuals.
Now, the main points include?
So the major elements, if it's adopted, it requires the city government to invest more in behavioral health services, mental health, substance use disorder treatment services. It creates a behavioral health rapid response capability so that a team of mental health professionals and others can respond on some occasions in lieu of the police, who are not always the best response option. It creates 2,000 units of emergency housing within 12 months of the adoption of the measure. It waives permit fees and refunds a portion of the city's sales tax for expenditures creating those 2,000 units.
But it would also ensure...
And it affirms the city government's ability to keep our parks and public spaces clear of encampments. It requires an assessment of racial disproportionality among the homeless population, and that is a very significant issue in Seattle, and then to take steps to address that so that it is less of a problem.
In this discussion was also Rachel Smith, who is CEO of the Seattle Metro Chamber of Commerce. And she says the critics, and the big criticism here is because you have business groups, you've got the providers who really do a lot of the work with our homeless population, many of them all on board and kind of collaborated on this proposed charter amendment. But you do have some of those providers on the other side. I think it's mainly like the Nicholsville folks and people like that who say that, nope, this is just a Trojan horse, really, for more sweeps, simply to be able to come in and be the new norm, kind of criminalizing homelessness. Rachel Smith with the Metro Chamber of Commerce says no.
I can tell you that when it comes to people living unsheltered in parks and on streets, just requiring someone to move with nowhere to go and no supports just moves them. It does just that. And so if you want to close encampments, you really have to do what works. And increasingly, we know what that is. It's doing the right kind of outreach. It's providing the right kinds of services, the right kinds of shelter. And when you do that, most people will come inside and encampments can be cleaned and closed. So, this is a far cry from a return to anything that we've seen, you know, done with any regularity.
Instead, she says what it will do.
You know, this is really keying off of what we know has been working lately. You know, we've seen the county has been moving people into hotels and providing services, programs like Just Care, run by the Public Defenders Association. Those are working, and those are getting folks to come inside by choice, and that's really the right thing. So I think it's a totally inaccurate to call Compassion Seattle anything like sweeps.
Now, you remember Just Care, I think we talked about it before you left for vacation, Dave, was the Andrew Lewis Public Defender Association program, where they were very similar, Compassion Seattle, mm-hmm. in that, where they kind of do what she just described. But the idea here is that focus of getting that visible difference down the line. So what happened, by the way, while you were gone with this whole charter amendment thing, is that they turned in their signatures. They had a very tight window, end of May. They turned in their signatures. They had to get something like a little over 30,000 to qualify, yeah. And they turned in nearly 65,000.
So I'm not surprised.
Looking pretty solid that they
this
will.
This is the first plan that actually says, we are going to make a visible difference.
Yes. Yes, yeah. That is the
planet. So on this issue of whether this actually is just a Trojan horse for sweeps, we shouldn't sugarcoat it. My understanding of it is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that this will not be an option. That once you're offered housing, that being your own place with a bathroom, right, you are not going to be allowed to camp in the parks anymore. That's just not going to be allowed, correct?
Right. You're not going to be allowed to park in the camps anymore. But the critical point here is that they aren't even going to start doing that, where they start getting people out of parks, until they have that, infrastructure or that capacity, if you will, to have a place for people to go. And again, we're talking about not just an emergency shelter overnight, but the wraparound services and everything to help that person navigate back into, a regular kind of life as much as they can. Or permanent supportive housing.
Right. You mentioned that assuming this all passes, it creates 2,000 units within a year. Is that what you said?
Yes, that's within a year.
Okay. Now, is that just by fiat, or is there money behind that?
That's what you heard Tim Burgess said. I believe this has to do with something that the state legislature passed, and it's basically a sales tax rebate. So I think the sales tax that the city collects that it normally gets to the state, it gets to have back
to
do this.
It. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this then would be, because a year is not enough, it seems to me, to build that kind of housing from scratch. So we're talking about buying up existing buildings. Is that right?
Right. There's a big focus. And I thought somewhere in there, maybe somebody said it, the focus on the hotels and the motels, right, or the existing structures that you can get people in. It's, Mayor Durkin talked about it not that long ago at a press conference I was with. It's really what you're hearing collectively from the county down, and even in some other jurisdictions, where if we can do this and buy these, and there's money from the state state budget as well for this, put them in a place immediately that is considered a temporary housing, where maybe you stay 12 to 18 months, whatever it is, until that permanent supportive housing can be built up. There's a lot of it coming online. It's going to be a few years, though, so we have to have that kind of temporary spot for everybody. So that's the goal.
Right. So is it still your feeling that we are actually in virgin territory here when it comes to a solution to Seattle's homeless problem?
I think we are in virgin territory. Just not that I haven't heard some of these ideas before. I just haven't seen the collaboration when it comes to these ideas before that I am seeing right now. You know, can I promise you that it's going to be successful? Certainly not. I hope that there's follow through. I really, really do. The one kind of caveat to all of this is that you've got an election, a city election coming up from the top down, right? So who knows? Plus, the Regional Homeless Authority is now just kind of getting into play. I think from what I've heard in my discussions with everybody, there's a lot of folks here on the same page. Let's just hope that politics doesn't get in the way. I want to say really quick, in Everett, they are opening that new shelter, kind of the same idea, wraparound services as tiny houses there on Smith Avenue, where that new law took effect, 10-block area in that by the Everett Gospel Mission, where it is now illegal as of today to sit or lie, block businesses, sidewalks, that kind of thing.
And just to double check, in terms of the Seattle mayor's race, no one is running on a platform of let's keep camps in the parks, right?
Not to that campaign strategy straight out, but there are those who are absolutely compassionate, want to let people do things in their own time. Sure, there's some candidates like that. I don't know that they're in the top field, but there's a few talking like that.
All right, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
A 96-year-old California woman took a trip 30 years ago ahead of her retirement, and as soon as she landed, her life was changed forever. CBS's Jamie Yukas tells us how.
Some people never find their purpose in life, but 96-year-old Olga Marie did right before she retired.
And I thought to myself, this is what I want to do. This is perfectly. Of course, I had no idea how to do it.
At the end of her legal career, Olga took a vacation to a place she'd never been.
You just went to Nepal on a whim.
Yes. And the minute I landed, I fell in love with the country. The children, they held my hand. They were just so delightful. And they all wanted to go to school. Most kids didn't go to school then.
It was there she had an epiphany.
Olga, you know what you're going to do for the rest of your life? You're going to educate Nepali children.
That started a now 30-year passion, building the Nepal Youth Foundation, combating poverty, building schools, and rescuing girls forced into servitude.
We were going to not be the great white saviors, but we would train them to save their sisters.
The charity has built 72 hospitals and helped educate more than 50,000 kids.
But she says there's so much more that needs to be done.
I don't think about stopping, frankly. You know, as long as I have my marbles and I'm healthy, I'll just continue to do that.
Continue living a life full of purpose. Jamie Yukis, CBS News.
And that is your Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft.
And now from the G. Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. So the question, burning question that I have for you is, when does G. Jr. get his first bobblehead deal?
Oh, man. Okay. You know, when I come onto your show and I do my show, I'm very transparent. You know, I try to, you know, talk about these topics in a real way. And so this name, image, likeness, it hit last Wednesday. You were gone. And let me just set the stage for all of you. Yes, this is an opportunity for these young men in college to now finally be able to get paid some money, endorsements off of their name, image, and likeness. So I thought that, oh, okay, this is cute, right? This would be good. You make a little bit of money. But I know that there's going to be all these restrictions that are going to be put in place. There's going to be all these rules that are be put in place. So therefore, there's going to be a cap on the amount of money that they make, and boy was I wrong. There, first, let me just start off by telling you, there's no cap.
No.
None.
They threw in the towel. It's the free market now.
It's the exact free market. So that's number one. Number two is there used to be, it was going to be a rule in place that NFL agents could not come and be a part of this and help with these student athletes. Nope, that's lifted now. Now they can get NFL agents now. So what you're hearing from me is this. As a father who has been around the NFL for 18 years, there's a lot of stories that I've seen. I was just on the phone last night talking about this. How many times I've seen young men get these contracts, get this money, and all of a sudden fall out with family because they're not giving family money. Or they're, you know, hey, I used to take you to practice. I did all these things when you were younger. Now you're forgetting about me. Right. And that what they have to go through, the hard time of saying no. So now my son's in that situation, right? So now has he gotten paid yet? No, he hasn't gotten paid $1. Has he gotten some different offers? Yes. Hey, there's a clothing company. We want you to wear our clothes. We'll send you something once a month, and then we'll also do a, and I'm telling you a real story. We'll also give you a percentage of the clothes that get sold. Wow. I told my son, you're not a salesman. You know, you don't get it. You're not going to be getting up every single day.
So you told him no? I mean, you advised against it?
Yes, I advised against it. You're not going to be waking up every morning wondering, oh, how much of a percentage did I get today? That's not your job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
So a lot of these things, a lot of people are going to be coming at him. And so what I'm saying is, what you guys are hearing from me, is I wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared for the NCAA to say, okay, like you just said, Dave, I'm throwing in the towel, the free market, it's all open now. And I'm like, wait, I didn't have time for this. I didn't think that my son would be in this situation in 2023.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Do you think the NCAA did this to basically force the issue, to make it look so out of control that people will then clamor to pull it back?
Bingo.
Yeah.
Bingo, Dave. So last night in this conversation, I had to see, like, why would they do this? And there it is. They want to let it be to where there's going to be schools, there's going to be families and parents like, hey, can we get some rules in place?
Uh-huh.
Because right now, there are no rules. The only rules technically are that my son can't go and do an appearance with the Ohio State Buckeye apparel on.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's it. What you can't do. But other than that, can he go and get endorsements in town? HVAC, roofing, plumbing, car dealerships, law firms, right? He can go and get all of that right now today and be able to get those things. So I've told my son, I'm like, look, man, you are there to play football. You are not there to be a salesman. You are not there to be going all these business meetings. Because at the end of the day, what really sells is how well you do on the football field. You want to know why DK Metcalf is one of the most marketable players in the NFL? Because of what he does on the football field.
Sure.
Because of him chasing down Buda Baker.
Well,
on
you don't want to. Yeah, you don't want to lose your let this brave new world cost you your concentration. You still he understands he has to work. I mean, otherwise he wouldn't have gotten this far.
But let me just tell you though, it's not easy. And what I mean is not easy. I'll tell you guys another story. I'll bore you. So on Thursday of last week, he calls me, mm-hmm. Dad. You see that post? One of his teammates went to Raising Cane's. Raising Cane's is a great chicken spot. I don't know if you've ever had it, but it's amazing. He went to Raising Cane's, and so he got $1,000 to post on Instagram him going to Raising Cane's in a picture. So that type of peer pressure, right? Like, Dad, he got $1,000. Dad, this person got this. This person got that. One of his teammates went to go sign 300 football cards of himself and got $3,000.
Wow.
So 300 football cards.
You're right. This is going to get out of control real fast.
Right. And so I say to my son, I said, okay. Now, your teammate has not made it professionally yet. But let's just say that your teammate does make it professionally. That means that there are 300 cards on the market that were worth $10 each because he's already signed it.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So this is a way for a lot of these players to offer themselves, give themselves before they are really big. Imagine DK Metcalf signing 1,000 cards before he made it to the pros. Now, a DK Metcalf card, signed card, isn't worth as much today as it was before. Yeah. Again, this is what happens when you have a weirdo dad like me, and this is what my son has to hear me just rain down on his parade, and it's almost like I'm a hater. You know, like, Dad, you're such a hater. No, Dad's not just a hater. I just have seen the other side.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock with Ursula. Thanks, G. Good luck. Starting today, it is illegal to sit or lie down in a 10-block area of downtown Everett. And joining us now to explain how this is going to work, Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah?
Yeah, Dave. So this is basically the city of Everett wanted to do something to deal with the situation down on Smith Avenue over by the I-5 overpass that's near downtown Everett. It's an area near the Everett Gospel Mission where they often help with the homeless that are out there. They've had tarps and tents out there just for years, and it's been a very big problem, especially for the businesses in that area. And so the city was deciding whether to use some money from the state to start some tiny homes. They linked these two things together so that they, as soon as these tiny homes were ready, they could go ahead and start enforcing this no sit, no lie law, which basically says around these 10 blocks, you cannot sit or lay down in the streets or the sidewalks. Many of the business owners were fed up with what they had been dealing with.
There are a number of homeless that do need help, but there's also a large number that are criminal elements. Where are my rights to have a safe, secure workplace?
Everett and Smith Street are just becoming another extension of these problems that we see and hear about in Seattle and Portland.
Business owners down here is when a massive drama happens. When we are quiet, everyone is content to just let the neighborhood go, and whatever happens to us just happens. I support the no sit, no lie because I need some kind of indication from the city that they will not just let us all fail down here. That as they grapple with the best ways to help the homeless population, they remember that we have needs and rights too. That the next big drama will not be something truly tragic that we can't come back from. A major fire, a major injury, or all of us going out of business as our customers lose faith in the safety of the neighborhood.
But at the same time, others called it harsh.
You can tell we need better leadership when you have a societal implosion and all you want to do is blame the homeless as a crime while looking the other way on evil, low-level crack, meth, and heroin pushers and sex crimes.
One of the harmful things that will happen with this no-sit, no-law, if it passes, is the increase of public discrimination towards the homeless. I've been shocked at the vile things that have been said to me and been said and posted just because I'm opposing this. Like, people don't understand homelessness, so they'd rather just hate them.
I'm convinced that if this ordinance passes, the leadership and vision required of our city council to address these issues of housing, mental health, addiction, trauma, and poverty, that are currently facing our city is broken.
So the pilot program for these tiny homes is open now today. It's right there by the Everett Gospel Mission. They'll have 6 people moving in today. It can house up to 30. They hope to have 15 by the end of the week. And Everett Mayor Cassie Franklin made clear that the goal...
The goal is not to arrest those experiencing homelessness, but to increase safety in the area, in an area that's really been overwhelmed by the crime and the street-level social issues. So as I think a couple of our council members also shared, the pilot program is a pilot. If it's successful, it's scalable and replicable, which is our hope.
So that's the plan here. They hope to, as we talked about last hour with some of the Compassion Seattle stuff, build on this. If it works, if we can get these people into these tiny homes temporarily, get them some wraparound services, maybe we can scale it up.
Well, are there enough tiny homes available to house all the people who are now on the street?
No, not right now. So again, it's a pilot. They can house up to 30 people. It's very low barrier.
That's not going to help the merchants then, right?
But that's what they can scale up. Yeah. And it took a day to erect the ones that they have now. So
are they
going to
start enforcing the no sit, no lie before there's enough homes for all the people who've been sitting and lying?
They can start enforcing it today. The plan, it sounds like, is to just have the cops do kind of an education thing first. I'm not sure for how long. But again, they can put
Just to cut to the chase, if they start enforcing it without places for people to go to, they'll just go someplace else to a different neighborhood, right?
They'll go someplace else. I mean, it's possible they end up in jail if they don't listen. And that's a whole nother discussion, though. So, yeah, and they would just go further into downtown, most likely to one of the other parks. So that's not the goal here, though. That's not what the idea is. The idea is to see if this works, if it's successful, and some of these people who do get in there. If so, they've already got a waiting list of like 60 people. So, but again, they can put them up fast. So we'll see.
Anna Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
And it's Tuesday. Time to go to the nation's capital. And the man who last week was easily the busiest reporter in America, the Washington Post's David Farenthold. The Trump Organization case hit the headlines big time, and I saw your byline on at least 3 extensive stories. So just tell me what the week has been like for you.
Well, it's nice to have some activity finally. I mean, we've been hearing about what was going to happen, all these predictions. It was nice to actually see what the prosecutors had. So we got confirmed on Wednesday night last week that the Trump Organization and its CFO had been indicted. And then Thursday morning, we were, deployed all around the courthouse. I was watching one door for Weisselberg to come in. Somebody else was camped out in the hallway for like 6 hours to get the shot of him walking by. So we got to feel like real New York City police reporters.
Good for you. Did you yell questions at him as he walked in?
Oh, yeah. I ran. I chased after him unsuccessfully, yelled questions at him. He didn't answer anything. So, yeah, the full
you
experience.
You guys. You're merciless. all right. The company's statement is that what we're seeing here is an inappropriate use of a local prosecutor's vast and unchecked power to target a political opponent. And the point they're making is that these are charges like this, tax evasion, are usually handled as civil infractions and with a fine. But they're talking criminal charges here. So explain why this is a criminal case.
The difference usually between civil cases and criminal cases is that a civil case, all you have to do is prove that somebody evaded taxes. They didn't pay the taxes they should have. A criminal case, you need to prove that they knew what they were doing and they did it anyway. And what prosecutors have said is that they actually got a roadmap to the criminal case from the Trump Organization itself. The Trump Organization kept a secret set of books in which they basically detailed all the money that they were hiding from the IRS. And by finding that second set of books, they got proof. The prosecutors got proof of 2 things they needed. A, they got a proof of how big the fraud was because they could see exactly how much money had been hidden. And B, that they understood that Trump Org knew what they were doing was wrong because they kept this other set of books and hid it from everybody else.
Okay, so what was the whole idea was to get out of paying taxes. Is there a way you can explain clearly to non-accountants what the Trump Organization's secret recipe was for allegedly evading these taxes?
Well, I will try. So take Alan Weisselberg, who's the CFO of the Trump Organization. They set his pay every year at $940,000 a year. But what the prosecutor said was that they then just schemed for ways to hide as much of the $940,000 from the IRS as they could. And so they did things like they paid for an apartment for Alan Weisselberg, and they took that out of the $940,000. They bought cars or leased cars for Weisselberg and his wife. They took that out of the $940,000. They paid tuition for his kids, his grandkids' school, and bought carpet for his house in Florida. Every one of those things was deducted from the $940,000. And so then they would got down to, you know, $700,000 was left, and they paid him $700,000 in his paycheck. But then they only told the IRS about the part they put in the paycheck, the $700,000. The rest of it that they paid out all those other ways, even though to the Trump Organization that was Alan Weisselberg's pay, they didn't tell the IRS about it, and they avoided taxes on that chunk of his pay.
So in other words, they wrote those things off as like a business deduction.
Exactly. Or, yes, like holiday gifts, rent expenses, all kinds of things that were not his pay. But they then kept a spreadsheet in which they were like explicitly, yes, this is his pay. We're just hiding part of it.
Okay. Now, I just want to stipulate, that's bad. You shouldn't do that. But we're only talking about $200,000 here.
Oh, no, more than that. They say that Weisselberg alone got $1.7 million of untaxed income, and he should have paid $900,000 of taxes on that. It's not billions of dollars, but talking to tax law experts the last couple of days, they said, look, when you stumble across a case like this where a company kept two sets of books, you prosecute it. And there's two reasons you prosecute it. One is it's easy. The company's given you a roadmap to prosecute them. Number two, that if you don't do something like that, if you let people get away with two sets of books with that kind of blatant tax evasion, you undermine the whole tax system.
David, Heather Bosch here, quick question. They kept books on what they were doing that was allegedly illegal? Why would they do that?
Well, I think this is a collision of two of Trump's values. One was not keeping records. That's usually his MO. Remember in the White House, he made people tear up their records and not take notes on his meetings. But the other one was cheapness. And the cheapness won out here. Let me explain why. Alan Weisselberg, you know, they set his salary at $940,000. But they didn't just sort of pay him fringe benefits willy-nilly. They kept track of them because they wanted to make sure that in this scheme, Alan didn't get a dollar more than he was supposed to. And that's the purpose of these records, is to make sure Alan doesn't get extra money as part of this scheme. He only gets the $940,000 he's promised. And in the course of tracking that and saving themselves money, they allegedly created a roadmap for prosecutors.
Okay, so you're saying they didn't target Trump just because he's Trump. They targeted him because he made it easy.
Yeah, well, they targeted him originally because of Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen goes on television in 2018 and 2019 and says, hey, listen, I'm a turncoat from the Trump Organization, and they're committing crimes right and left. And that gets them, the prosecutors, interested in the Trump Organization. But they stumble across these second set of books. And again, like, that's what we've been told. Yeah. If you're a prosecutor and you find that, you got to prosecute it because it's easy.
Okay. What if now Trump was not named in this. What if it turns out that Trump told his lawyers, hey, this is what I want to do. You guys take care of it. I don't want to know. Just make sure it's legal and that you tell me it's legal.
If that's going to be the crux of the next phase of this case, is questions like that. As you said, Trump's CFO is charged, but not Trump himself. Trump's company was charged, but not Trump himself. To go from the charges we have today to charges against Trump, you would need some kind of proof of Trump's intent. That he said, okay, I know this is illegal. I want you to do it anyway. And if there's something in the middle, like yeah, his lawyers told him it was okay, or Weisselberg didn't tell him they were doing this, that breaks the chain and you couldn't charge Trump with these crimes. And I think that's why prosecutors are so interested in getting the cooperation of Alan Weisselberg, is he's one of the few people who could really tell them what Trump said and what was in Trump's mind at the time.
Is it possible that there are other companies that do this same thing? Would this send a – this is my concern, all right? You go through this whole thing, and all you do is send a message to the Trump Organization, which was silly enough, apparently, to keep these two sets of books easily accessible. Whereas I am guessing, David, that there are many other companies, some of them probably pretty big ones, which are hiding a lot more money than this from the federal government.
Probably right. I mean, so the Trump Organization's defense has been a version of that. You know, their sort of political defense has been everybody does this, nobody gets caught, you know, which is like, just because there are other people out there who are getting away with this doesn't create a right for everyone to get away with it. Right. If it's illegal, it's illegal. People speed all the time.
But if this succeeds, I'm saying, will this send a message to all those companies that are doing that, or is this just going to affect the Trump Organization?
Well, I mean, I guess it's what's in the mind of those companies. But a high-profile prosecution of this kind of tax fraud, I mean, I think it, under normal circumstances, would send a message that you can't do that. At least it gets the word out that you can't do that. You know, whether people would be like, well, I'm not Donald Trump, so they'll never come after me. I don't know.
David Farenthold from The Washington Post. Do you have a busy week ahead of you this week, or are you taking it off?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question because I don't want to jinx myself. But there's nothing scheduled for the rest of the week that's going to be as busy as last week.
Okay. I always have to check. David joins us every Tuesday, and all his stuff is at thewashingtonpost.com, of course. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Social distancing has been relaxed. We're getting beautiful weather, going to have a great sunny weekend coming up, and so a lot of people are out on boats. But things can get dangerous if you get careless. Here's Cairo Radio's Nicole Jennings, who spent a day with local rescuers.
On any of these sunny summer days, looking out at Lake Union or Lake Washington, you'll see people on yachts, sailboats, kayaks, and paddle boards all enjoying the state's beauty. But there's a dangerous undercurrent to the recreation. In just the last 2 weeks, the King County Sheriff's Office has seen about a dozen drownings. And in the last week, assisted in about 100 rescues.
On years that we have it get really hot at the beginning of summer, we see more drownings in rivers, and we see more people on the water, so we see more drownings in the water.
Deputy Ben Callahan is part of the office's marine unit, which goes around Lake Washington, Lake Union, and other local lakes and rivers, enforcing boating law, educating people on water safety, investigating accidents, and rescuing people in trouble. Unfortunately, when summers start out with hot weather early on and rivers and lakes are still icy with melting snowpack, the water can prove especially deadly.
The first thing is cold water shock. That some people, it can create a cardiovascular response that just causes a heart attack. And so falling into cold water just in and of itself can be a life-threatening situation.
Deputy Callahan says even for a strong swimmer who's prepared to fall in, being in 60-degree water for several minutes can quickly cause your limbs to stop working as your body focuses on protecting its vital organs. Add in a panicked response and you'll soon burn what little energy you could have used trying to get back to shore. This is especially dangerous if you jump off or fall off a boat in the middle of a lake like Lake Washington, where the water is deeper and gets tens of degrees colder the deeper that you go. The biggest mistake people make on the water, says Callahan, is not being prepared for what to do if things go wrong.
What people oftentimes miss is that water is not an environment we're designed to survive in naturally. Anytime we go into wilderness or an environment we're not designed to live in, it takes planning, and people don't plan ahead.
Some of that is due to social media.
They think they're going into what they saw on Instagram. When we look at how social media portrays wilderness sports in general, it looks beautiful and peaceful and picturesque.
But in reality, lakes and rivers aren't always as ideal as they look in the photos. And boating, paddle sports, and swimming can all be very risky. Callahan says when people aren't prepared, they're in a recreation mindset, focusing only on having fun. That can put you at a real disadvantage in a crisis.
When we get caught off guard, it's that vacation mindset, right? We're behind the curve. We're trying to adapt to something we don't know how to adapt to. We're panicking.
So how can you get into the proper preparedness mindset? Deputy Callahan's biggest tip.
The one thing that would change a lot of scenarios is if people had life jackets on. I am a strong swimmer. I wear a life jacket when I go kayaking or paddleboarding. And I don't do it because I'm planning on drowning. I do it because I know there's things I can't control.
He assures us that the paddleboarders he sees with life jackets on are having just as much fun as those without. You should also go through the state's official boat inspection checklist to make sure you have all the essentials on board, like a fire extinguisher and visual distress signals. Also,
you have to have some kind of noise-producing device like a horn or a whistle. Checking the weather, planning ahead, looking for things that you don't know, and that's where I think the classes are important.
Even though you don't need a boater education card in this state to operate a kayak or paddleboard, officers recommend that you still take a course to learn the basics. They commonly rescue paddleboarders who buy the board and go out on the lake not really knowing what they're doing. They may not be drowning, but they get out a little bit too far and have trouble fighting the winds to get back to shore. Also important, take it slowly.
If you're going to buy a paddleboard, maybe take it to the pool first or a lifeguarded beach and play around with it in the swimming area for a while.
And taking it slowly goes for getting in the water, too.
What we do when we have to get into a swift water environment or get into a cold river is splash water in your face. Before you get in, if you get your face wet, at least your body has a sense of what you're about to shock yourself with.
Finally, be careful what you buy online and invest properly in safety. Officers say the most affordable boats are often the biggest culprits of trouble. If something sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Craigslist, someone buys a really cheap boat, like, oh, $1,200 for this, you know, old Boston Whaler sounds like a great deal, until you realize that it was $1,200 because the engine breaks down 5 minutes into your voyage and now you're stuck out in the middle of the lake.
Ultimately, the Marine unit wants you to get out on the water this summer, have fun, and relax. And you can relax even more knowing that just in case things don't go entirely to plan, you know what to do.
Our radio's Nicole Jennings. The deadline for getting U.S. troops out of Afghanistan was September 11th. So naturally, they left last Friday. U.S. forces left Bagram Air Base, which had been the center of operations for the military for about 20 years. The Taliban's taking full advantage of that. Let's go to CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Jeff, I was watching some clips from Afghanistan TV, RTA, and they're sounding very positive. They showed pictures of villagers with military weapons, men and women, saying they're ready to take on the Taliban and take back their country. Is that going to happen?
Boy, there remains to be seen. You know, the last few weeks, it's not much cause for optimism in the broader sense. I mean, I just give you one statistic. On 1 May of 2021, the Taliban controlled 73 districts across the country. There are about 400 districts in Afghanistan. As of this past week, they now control 195 districts. They have roughly tripled the area that they control, now probably control more land area and more population than does the government, and they contest the government in probably another 129 or 130 districts around the country. That being said, we have seen this emergence once again of almost local security or even warlordism that has bedeviled Afghanistan throughout its history. And we saw this happen in the immediate aftermath of the Soviet Union pulling out, that the country fractured along ethnic lines with warlords leading various groups. And that stymied the Taliban from ever taking full control of the country. And that certainly could happen again.
Yeah, I mean, those people don't look like pushovers to me, and they've been through so much. It seems to me that if you're faced with a choice between running your own village and having the religious police going around swatting people and blowing up schools that educate females, I would think you would fight that. But I guess the question is, do they have the weapons to do it? Did you see those pictures of all the weaponry that was left behind? Why did that happen? I thought that when you retreat, you blow up your weapon stash, don't you?
Well, one would have thought, and the Pentagon's reporting that, you know, the vast amount of heavy weaponry was, in fact, removed from Bagram Base when we threw from there. Certainly all the aircraft were pulled out of there. There still were significant amounts of small arms ammunition that were taken over by, hopefully, the Afghan forces who occupied the base in the aftermath. But unfortunately, along with those happy scenes you showed, there have been other photographs and scenes of Afghan soldiers basically throwing down their weapons, surrendering without a fight, and handing over their weapons and equipment to the Taliban. I mean, the last few days, there were reports of up to 1,000 Afghan soldiers fleeing across the border up in the north from Afghanistan into Tajikistan. And they were quoted as saying, "We're doing this to save our lives," and maybe 1,500 more have in fact done this. And we've seen similar exoduses in other parts into Uzbekistan and Pakistan. But you're right. I mean, you don't want those weapons to pass over the other side. But right now, it certainly appears that the Taliban have enormous firepower and have acquired a lot more firepower along with districts over the last few weeks.
Who is supporting the Taliban now?
Well, most of the support for the Taliban comes from Pakistan. And there still is a widespread belief amongst some experts that the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, provides assistance and advice to the Taliban. But at the same time, the Taliban is somewhat homegrown and home-sustaining. Don't forget, again, despite spending literally millions and millions of dollars, the United States was unable to stem the production of poppy heroin, particularly in southern Afghanistan, which has been a traditional stronghold of the Taliban. And in the last year, we've seen the greatest production of poppy and heroin coming out of Afghanistan that we've seen in recorded history. And a substantial portion of the profits for that drug trade do, in fact, go to the Taliban.
Colonel Heather Bosch, quick question for you. Curious, we got involved in Afghanistan really to root out terrorism. And as a layperson, I want to know, what are the odds that we could see another 9/11, that terrorism will just take over again?
Well, Heather, first, it's great to talk to you, I want to say. But, you know, that's a possibility and a point of real concern. The Biden administration has been very adamant that due to the decimation of Al-Qaeda, which has occurred not only in the immediate aftermath of the seizure of Afghanistan, but subsequently, that we don't think they're in the position to do that, at least for several years. And secondly, the argument, which many make, and with good cause, that, you know, if you leave Afghanistan under the Taliban control in large areas, ungovernable, this provides areas where the Al-Qaeda or other groups, ISIS and the like, could use to train, organize, and equip forces. And that could happen over time. But that being said, there are a lot of those kind of places around the world, in Syria, Yemen, et cetera, where Al-Qaeda could do the same thing.
CBS military analyst, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.